show, this is your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan, bringing you the June 9th edition of the New Yorker magazine. Today's main story is how a hazelnut spread became a sticking point in Franco-Algerian relations by Lauren Collins. Letter from France, how a hazelnut spread became a sticking point in Franco-Algerian relations. The wildly popular Nutella competitor, El Morjoun, had been banned from the European Union, a move some see as politically motivated, by Lauren Collins. Every summer in France, an exodus takes place. It invariably begins in early July, when public school lets out, kicking off les grandes vacations. This year, the last day of school is July 4th. On July 5th, the country's airports, highways, and ferry terminals will swell with outbound travelers. Among them will be many of France's 7.3 million immigrants, who constitute some 10% of the population, and the descendants of immigrants, who account for many millions more. Nearly a third of children born in France in 2023 had at least one parent born abroad. The exodus is a charged moment, an annual transmigration of people, money, goods, gifts, expectations, and yearnings nurtured through the long European winter. The ritual is colloquially known as le retour au bled, the return to the homeland, or the return to the village, a combination of the French word for return and the Arabic word for country. Le retour au bled, two parts of you stretching over a preposition and a C, going home with yawning kids, a fresh haircut, and a suitcase full of cheese and chocolate. Weeks pass and the diasporas return. What's in the suitcases now? Every community has its informal imports, lovingly swaddled in socks and Ziplocs, and made to last until the next trip to the motherland. From Cameroon, there's shea butter and moringa powder. From Turkey, ketchup, sweeter and smoother than the French version. People with roots in the United States load up on gel caps, extra strength deodorant, and tooth whitening strips. Peanut butter, an emulsion, is considered a liquid by the Transportation Security Administration. As I learned when 7 months pregnant, I was forced to surrender a much longed-for jar of Jif. Travelers coming back from Algeria have long stuffed their bags with dates, olive oil, BMO biscuits, and grenadine soda. Last summer, they made space for another item, a hazelnut spread called El Morjoun. El Morjoun is produced by Cibon, a baking products company based in Tipaza, near Algiers. It comes in two main varieties, cocoa hazelnut, colloquially known as brown, and hazelnut cream, colloquially known as white. There is also Rocher, a crunchy version of each color. The spread debuted in 2021 on the Algerian market, where it retails for roughly €5 a jar. El Morjoun is not widely sold in France, but it has long been procurable in small quantities at slightly elevated prices, mostly in independent shops offering products from North Africa. The white kind is the most popular for its silky texture and intensely sweet flavor, which is said to resemble the filling of a Kinder Bueno candy bar. Last summer, as traffic between France and Algeria underwent its annual spike, influencers, many of them with Algerian connections, started touting the spread. "This thing, it's sick," one TikToker raved. Another swore that it was better than Nutella. Yet another simply plunged an entire baguette into a jar and shoved it, dripping into his gob. Soon the presenters of the morning show on BFMTV, one of France's most watched news channels, were conducting a live tasting, licking El Morjoun straight off the spoon. On playgrounds, a new chant rang out, "Who wants El Morjoun? Whoop whoop." A shopkeeper in Chalet, a mid-sized town, reported that he had sold 1,000 jars of El Mortajón in 5 hours. In most cities, it became almost impossible to find. The grocery giant Carrefour announced its intention to stock El Mortajón, and Siobhan vowed to keep its factories running 24 hours a day. Prices soared to 10 euros as word circulated of Soviet-style rations. Now people were posting videos of El Mortajón hunts, crisscrossing cities for hours in search of a jar. The comedian Yunus Hanafi joked, "Is it hazelnut spread or is it Coke?" One rainy afternoon in Paris, I met with Johan Pappas, a popular content creator, in the hope of understanding the craze. He had chosen a fancy cafe in the 8th arrondissement, and he arrived accompanied by his sister Lisa. Last August, the siblings helped kick off the obsession with El Mortajón by sampling the brand's spreads in a TikTok crash test. In a video, they sit side by side, their hoard arrayed on a table in front of them. "Le jour de la gloire est arrivé," Johan declares, quoting from the opening lines of the French national anthem, while Lisa begins to ululate. As we waited for tea and crepe, I asked Johan how he'd first heard about Beige Gold, as one commentator has dubbed El Mortajón. "What I saw was Algerian guys and girls posting about it," he recalled. "And as an Algerian myself, actually, I was born and raised in France, but my parents are Algerian. I wanted to try it, because why not?" Johan had a track record of turning food novelties into social media sensations. One of his best-known videos, about a Parisian bakery's cookie, a croissant stuffed with cookie dough, has been viewed more than 3 million times. For him, El Mortajón's appeal was as much outside the jar as inside it. "It's the first time that an Algerian product went viral in France," he said. "And we have such a complex history, right?" The crepes arrived. The Papsits, it turned out, had brought a surprise. Lisa reached into an enormous Dior tote and felt around. Eventually, her hand emerged, gripping an ovoid glass jar with a pale yellow label. It was illustrated with a cross-section of a gooey candy bar, a dollop of beige cream spiraling up into a wave-like crest, and a few free-floating hazelnuts and leaves. In the center was a red-lipped woman wrapped in a white hike. The words El Mortajón hovered over her chest in Arabic and French, accompanied by toasted hazelnut cream. "Lisa's got the gold," Johan said, readying a knife to dip. In early September, customs authorities at the port of Marseille and at Charles de Gaulle Airport outside Paris refused to allow two separate shipments of El Mortajón to enter French territory. Both lots, about a dozen pallets total, of 840 jars each, belonged to independent importers who had never before run into trouble. The rationale for the goods' rejection wasn't clear. On one form, customs officials wrote that the spread appeared to infringe the trademark, designs, and model of the Ferraro Group, the makers of Nutella, who sell tens of millions of jars in France each year. For several days, the pallets remained in limbo. Then a decision came down from the French Ministry of Agriculture, which ensures food safety, formalizing the ban. Apparently, trademark infringement wasn't the issue. The problem was powdered milk and whey. Ingredients in El Mortajón, alongside sugar, hazelnuts, vegetable fat, and emulsifiers. EU law limits the importation of products that contain even a small amount of dairy. Algeria does not appear on a list of approved countries. The offending jars of El Mortajón would therefore have to be repatriated or sent elsewhere. A ministry spokesman vowed that it would open an investigation to determine the mechanisms of circumvention that until now have allowed this product to be placed on the market. When I inquired about the promised investigation, ministry officials were vague, responding only that it had been carried out in conjunction with the customs services and had revealed that erroneous customs declarations of these goods led to their being placed on the market. If El Mortajón was in short supply before, now it became mythically scarce. Prices climbed to 20, even 30 euros a jar. I scared one up on Vinted, a Lithuanian resale site, transferring 40 euros to an Algerian woman living in France who had just been home for her grandfather's funeral. She explained, "Since I bake a lot, I stocked up." Marmiton, the French cooking site, published a DIY recipe for suffering fans. "Don't panic," the piece said. Meanwhile, in Marseille, police were investigating an El Mordejon ambush when a shopkeeper sent a young employee to pick up a pallet for sale on the internet. The employee was robbed at gunpoint of $6,000. Executives at Sabon found the French authorities' reasoning suspicious. Clearly, they were looking for a loophole, and Amin Ouzlifi, a company spokesman, told me. They considered a bunch of options and finally settled on dairy products as the most viable. The timing also seemed fishy. El Mordejon, Ouzlifi pointed out, had been available in France for years, but overnight, as soon as there was a buzz, they blocked it, trotting out legislation that previously had not been enforced. On social media, pride curdled into exasperation. "You're jealous because this brand is 100% Algerian. The production is 100% Algerian, and seeing Algeria succeed really pisses you off," one user said. Memes circulated, likening El Mordejon to Aman Khalif, the Algerian boxer, who was the subject of so much hateful speculation about her gender during the 2024 Paris Olympics that she eventually filed a cyber harassment lawsuit. The implication was that El Mordejon would eventually knock out Nutella, just as Khalif had dominated her Italian opponent and gone on to win the gold medal. Another meme hinted at the colonial legacy of immigration headaches and administration asymmetries between the countries. It depicted El Mordejon as a bride marrying Nutella to get its papers. "The only solution for getting El Mordejon back in France," the caption read, "congratulations, newlyweds." In Algeria, the reaction was indignant. Mustafa Zebdi of the Algerian Organization for the Protection of Consumers and Their Environment, APOCE, denounced an abusive decision, arguing that it established a precedent for the EU to bar competitive products from Algeria under dubious pretexts. El Mordejon started to pose a problem the second it became a star. Habib Meroni Haj Bekosh, an APOCE spokesman, told me. Other commentators decried disguised protectionism and the flagrant injustice of the prohibition. The website Maghreb Emergent observed, "The El Mordejon affair perfectly illustrates the contradictions of a globalized economy where borders are disappearing for capital but are rising up against innovative products from emerging countries." Obviously, there was far more at stake than the question of which hazelnut spread French consumers would apply to their afternoon tartines. The spread affirms a freedom to be us here, Farah Karam, the author of Cuisines d'Afrique du Nord, North African Cuisines, told me. And it is precisely for this reason that the announcement to pull the product from the market was so violent for many. This goes beyond a commercial or legal framework. It touches on belonging, on the intimate, on the right to exist in public space as we are, with our tastes, our origins, our attachments. Still, Sabon executives tried to stay calm. "Why open the gates of hell?" Ouzlifi said, when I asked whether Sabon planned to contest the ban directly. He explained that the company was founded in 1997 by two brothers, Youssef and Karichi Farrar. Their first creation, a sugar syrup called Asila, caught on with bakers. Eventually, they began manufacturing smen, a fermented butter, and became interested in the applications of vegetable fats, resolving to develop a dessert spread. The project coincided with a push by President Abidjan Tebboune to lessen the country's dependence on extracted industries and to encourage entrepreneurs to develop goods for export. Demand for smen was limited largely to the Maghreb, but the Faras figured there was hardly a market on earth that wouldn't welcome sugary treats in unctuous, affordable form. They wanted to make something that could go anywhere in the world, Ouzlifi recalled. Tebboune, which now employs 800 people, has three factories. The one that manufactures El Mordejon is only a few miles from the Mediterranean. The sea inspired the Faras to give the product its name, which means red coral in Arabic. The woman on the label was intended to conjure both national pride and domestic aptitude. In Algerian tradition, the woman wears white garments, Ouzlifi told me. The El Mordejon woman, we don't know if she's veiled or if she's wearing something for cooking. Not long after the Ministry of Agriculture blocked El Mordejon, a twist emerged. The objectionable powdered milk was in fact French. As documents that Tebboune furnished attested, the company had recently imported 100 tons of powdered milk from a dairy firm in Brittany. The disclosure seemed to present an easy resolution to the dispute. If France sent the milk to Algeria, surely Algeria could send the milk back to France. But bizarrely, it didn't have much of an impact. The ban stood. Ouzlifi, hinting that he believed that Ferraro had influenced what was an essentially political decision, told me, European corporations will always protect themselves. A spokesperson for Ferraro would only say that the European Union authorizes the marketing of consumer products in France or elsewhere on the continent. Was a Nutella conspiracy behind the strangest quarrel in Franco-Algerian memory? In January, I flew to Rome to learn more about the storied brand. I knew from reading Nutella World, an adulatory book by Gigi Padovani, that Napoleon is the real father of Nutella because he provoked an 1806 blockade that caused a severe cane sugar shortage in Europe, leading to the development of beet sugar, which would later be used in the spread. I knew that World Nutella Day is observed every February 5th. I knew that in 2014, Italy's postal service issued a Nutella stamp. I knew that there are said to be 52 hazelnuts in every jar, that a 2-year supply could supposedly fill the Colosseum, that the Ferraros are the richest family in Italy, that someone wrote an opera buffa called Nutella Cantata, and that the German cycling star Jan Ulrich would purportedly microwave jars of Nutella and drink the resulting liquid through a straw like a milkshake. A friend's pediatrician claims that Nutella, not yogurt or applesauce, is the best delivery mechanism for unpalatable meds. Lady Gaga once tweeted, "Okay, firstly, yes, I love Nutella with banana plus Wonder Bread. Who doesn't?" Maxi, Italy's National Museum of 21st Century Art, was hosting an exhibition about Nutella at its Rome headquarters. A little confusingly, it was called Jaune, a play on joy and the letter N, as well as an invitation to join in, and it was presented with Ferraro's support in celebration of Nutella's 60th birthday. The brochure featured a quote from the late Italian journalist Enzo Biaggi, "I think the most effective ambassadors of our country were the restaurateurs who introduced people to pasta, olive oil, parmesan. Then there are the three names, all beginning with F, that are known everywhere, Fellini, Ferrari, and Ferraro." Chiara Bertini, the exhibit's curator, met me at the entrance in a striped velvet jacket and jeans. A specialist in Flemish painting and Foucault, she has a dual master's in museum studies and philosophy. Bertini admitted that Nutella has been a challenging brief. "I'm more accustomed to dealing with a piece of art," she explained. Yet she appreciated the opportunity to work on a subject of mass interest. "Nutella is Nutella," she said. we stepped onto a red carpet that ran the length of the gallery, curving as though it had been spread with a butter knife. A timeline marked important moments in the brand's history, beginning with the foundation of Pietro Ferrero's pastry shop in a small town called Dogliani in 1923. Pietro fell in love with a woman named Piera. They got married, had a son, and moved to Alba in Piedmont. Then Pietro briefly set off for Eritrea, at the time Italian East Africa, where he sold panettone to colonial troops. Back in Alba after the Second World War, the Ferreros, facing chocolate shortages, blended cocoa powder with locally available hazelnuts to create a product called Gianduja, after a type of traditional Piedmontese mask. Gianduja came in foil-wrapped bars that could be sliced into smaller portions for the impoverished Italian populace. This sweet for the humble was sold by weight at less than a fifth of the price of chocolate. A few years later, Ferrero launched a spreadable version of Gianduja called Super Crema, the true precursor to Nutella. As the exhibit noted, it was an immediate hit. Padovani writes that by the end of the 50s, Ferrero was transporting so much Super Crema that its automotive fleet was second only to that of the Italian military. The name Nutella was partially the result of legislative accident. In 1964, the Italian Parliament passed a law regulating the use of intensifiers like Super in advertising, forcing the Ferreros to rebrand Super Crema. The new name had to sound a little European, but also had to work around the globe. It had to be easy to pronounce and easy to remember. Eager to emphasize the product's hazelnut base, Ferrero considered Nutsy, Nutosa, Nutina, and Nestle, a portmanteau of nut and Ella, she in Italian. Nutella connoted health, pleasure, and a cozy femininity, its L's protruding from the mix of vowels like a pair of knives stuck into a jar. The French are the world's largest consumers of Nutella, and more of it is produced in Ferrero's factories near Rouen than anywhere else. In 2018, brawls broke out at French supermarkets that were offering the spread at a discount of 70%. One French couple was so enamored of the brand that they attempted to christen their newborn daughter Nutella. Courts rejected the names on the grounds that it would invite mockery and disobliging remarks, and suggested that the child be called Ella instead. Yet in recent years, a panoply of competitors have dipped into Ferrero's market share with products that are organic, palm oil free, vegan, fair trade, less sugary, or just more appealingly packaged than Nutella. Nutella always chooses to stay the same, Bertini said, as we examine the show. The taste is the same. The jar is the same. The values are the same. It always touches you in an emotional way. The Ferrero family, she explained, was the symbol of the Italian family, transmitting Nutella across the generations, alongside truths as seemingly consistent and comforting as a smear of hazelnut puree. Life was more natural. Your mother was always thinking of you, one slogan read. That's why you grew up properly and happy. And do you remember your mother gave you Nutella? Another historic tagline posed a thought experiment. What kind of world would it be without Nutella? Nutella, in other words, was mama, the motherland, the unchanging womb of everything warm and good. The Elm Mortaging affair went much deeper than a wacky food fight or an abstruse trade dispute. It wasn't really about hazelnut spreads. It was about nostalgia, memory, injustice, nationalism, globalization, decolonization, protectionism, racism, identity, immigration, invasion, the same things that all arguments are about nowadays, transposed to the realm of spreadable snacks. The corollary to the question, what kind of world would it be without Nutella, is what kind of world would it be with El Mortagin? I had hoped to visit El Mortajón's headquarters in Tipaza. At the beginning of December, I applied for a press visa at the Algerian embassy in Paris. The official who interviewed me was optimistic. The story I was proposing sounded fine, and I should have the necessary authorization in a few weeks. Press freedom in Algeria is highly limited. The country ranks 126 out of 180 in a Reporters Without Borders index. Weeks went by, then months. I still have not heard from the Algerian embassy. I am a French citizen, and in the period since being dropped off my dossier, the relationship between Algeria and France has radically deteriorated, resulting in what many commentators consider the most profound crisis between the two countries since Algeria gained independence in 1962. Relations between Algeria and France can be good or bad, but in no case can they be banal. The former Algerian President Harari Boumediene once observed, "His formulation captures the intimate, intense, and volatile dynamic that has existed between the countries since at least the coup de Vinchal affairs of 1827, when the Dey of Algiers struck the French council with a fly swatter over a dispute about an outstanding loan, eventually giving the French a pretext to invade. Colonization lasted for more than a century, bringing with it mass murder, famine, disease, displacement, and the settlement of more than 1 million Europeans on Algerian soil. In 1945, the Sétif and Guelma massacres, in which French police fired on parading townspeople, some protesting colonial rule, initiated a traumatizing decades-long conflict from which neither country has fully recovered. Algeria and France continue to be closely and often uncomfortably intertwined. Algeria's economy depends on French investment. French national security depends on the cooperation of Algerian authorities, and without dialogue, it is unlikely that either country will be able to move forward on important matters of historical justice. The French President Emmanuel Macron has described the Franco-Algerian relationship as a love story that has its share of tragedy, but he might more aptly have spoken of a tragic story that has its share of love. In his early years on the political scene, Macron devoted considerable energy to the reconciliation of memories with Algeria, calling colonization a crime against humanity, acknowledging torture by the French army, and commissioning what he hoped would be a game-changing report from the historian Benjamin Stora. According to news stories, Macron was stung by the report's lukewarm reception in Algeria. Meeting with members of Algerian memorial groups at the Elysee Palace in 2021, he denounced the Tebboune regime as a political military system that sustained itself on a hatred of France. The Algerian ambassador soon flounced out of Paris. 3 months later, he was back again, attending the inauguration of a monument to a hero of the Algerian resistance and declaring that the fight for friendship between Algeria and France goes on. The proximate cause of the latest dispute was not a fly swatter or a report, but a letter written by Macron and delivered to the King of Morocco in late July of last year. In it, the French president announced that he was supporting a Moroccan plan for the Western Sahara region, which has been the subject of a long-standing conflict with an Algerian-backed independence group. Macron's decision made a certain geopolitical sense, since France is trying to bolster its position in the Sahel, but it antagonized Algeria. On July 30th, Algeria withdrew its ambassador, and its Ministry of Foreign Affairs warned that France had not fully grasped the potential repercussions of its decision. The scuffles over El Mortajón in September were effectively a back-to-school prelude to serious trouble later in the fall. During a television interview in October, Thibon accused France of genocide and raised the literally radioactive issue of the fallout from 17. You're listening to the New Yorker Magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona, read by your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. Nuclear tests the French government had performed in the Algerian desert between 1960 and 1966. He declared that he was calling off a long-planned state visit to Paris, implying that he was unwilling to accept humiliation, a perennial byword in Franco-Algerian relations. At the same time, France was experiencing extreme instability in its domestic politics. Last summer, Macron dissolved the National Assembly, leaving the country without a prime minister for months. The current government relies on the tacit blessing of Marine Le Pen's far-right party, which effectively has veto power in the parliament. Algeria occupies a special place in the imagination of Le Pen and the French far-right. Marine's late father and the party's founder, Jean-Marie Le Pen, served as a paratrooper in the Algerian War and later admitted to torture. The party is often associated with the community of Pied-Noir, the French settlers who, as French rule crumbled, left Algeria, where many of them had lived for generations. They have bitterly mourned their losses of land, of status, of sun-dappled days in a remembered paradise ever since. Colonization brought a lot to Algeria, Marine Le Pen has said, claiming that even Algerians of good faith admit it. While glorifying the colonial era, she has lobbied to make it harder for Algerians to emigrate to France. After assuming the king-making seat in the assembly, she wasted no time in calling for a crackdown on the migratory submersion that she claims is ruining the country. If Algeria is a third rail of French politics, crackling with danger, it can also be a sorcerer's stone, lighting up mediocre politicians with borrowed potency. In January, Bruno Retailleau, the hardline minister of the interior, made a show of deporting an influencer known as Douleman, an Algerian who had been calling on TikTok for violence against an opponent of the Thibon administration. Douleman was loaded onto a flight from Paris to Algeria, whose government sent him right back. Algeria is seeking to humiliate France, Retailleau thundered. Diplomatic pandemonium broke loose. Threats, more deportations, an unspoken but very real mutual cutback on visas. On February 22nd, an Algerian citizen attacked shoppers at a market in the French city of Mulhouse with a knife, killing one person and wounding six others. The attacker, who was mentally ill, had served time for promoting terrorism and who was in France without a visa. French authorities said that they had tried to expel him 10 times, but that Algeria had refused to take him back. What began as a cyclical squabble between frenemy nations escalated into something different, a tectonic crisis, per Le Monde, a quarrel of unprecedented gravity, according to the AFP, the French news agency. The imbroglio over El Mordejon had to be understood in this context of vexed interdependence. You could almost trace the Franco-Algerian relationship through food, among the most primordial forms of exchange. The seized lands, the stripped fields, the introduction of non-native wheat, transforming Algeria into the breadbasket of France, and degrading the soil, the hundreds of thousands of tons of oranges, clementines, lemons, and grapefruits produced for the delectation of consumers from the metropole, the Algerian wine-producing regions that never appeared on French pedological maps, the spoiled tomatoes and rotten eggs that Europeans in Algiers lobbed at the politician Guy Mollet in 1956, fearing that his new socialist government in Paris would abandon French Algeria, the relocation of Orgina from Boufarik to Marseille, the weapons smuggled to independence fighters in baskets of animal feed, the couscous dishes that Pied-Noirs said they could still taste from their childhoods, the gruel that Harkis Algerians who fought with the French army during the war had to survive on after the French government repaid their service by interning them in camps. In Culinary Connections and Colonial Memories in France and Algeria, Colleen M. Gee examines the moral component of food, arguing that it can be used to create a gastronomic us and them that has long-term implications that play out in contemporary French politics. She writes that after phylloxera devastated French vineyards in the mid-19th century, Algerian wines began to compete with those made in the south of France, and Algerian winemakers faced accusations that they were blending their wines and fraudulently producing Bordeaux. The allegations reminded me that the El Mordejon affair had ample historical precedent. But if food can be a means of repelling the foreigner, it can also be a way for the foreigner to fight back. Some observers say that Algeria has enacted a shadow ban on French wheat. As of January, a single shipment had entered the country in the past year, compared with the usual millions of tons. Amid the geopolitical drama, El Mordejon was missing out on what had clearly had been a robust business in France. The dreadful thing is that there are copycat products everywhere, Oz Leafy told me. A few weeks after the El Mordejon ban, a company based in Normandy that manufactures a similar spread called Crema Bueno saw demand skyrocket. Unfortunately, the European Union's ban has put us in the spotlight, the company's co-manager joked in the press. Another new product, Nella Delice, had an Algerian flag on the label but was produced in Turkey. We made a strategic choice, the company's website confesses. On social media, a rumor began circulating that El Mordejon had been banned in France because its logo featured a woman wearing a veil. Right-wing commentators, meanwhile, presented El Mordejon as a sort of edible Trojan horse, meant to smuggle foreign values into France. The hype on TikTok, they claimed, was actually a concerted campaign of Algerian Muslim proselytism, while the hike-clad woman on the jar recalled members of the Algerian National Liberation Front responsible for the deaths of innumerable French. The far-right site Boulevard Voltaire vowed, "Tonight at our place, it'll be Andalie sausage and Nutella crepes." Oz Leafy shrugged off the haters, saying that for every sale that the company had lost in France, it gained another from Algerian solidarity after Europe's ban. "If there's French chauvinism, there's Algerian chauvinism too," Haj Bekouche, the APOC spokesman, told me. He was right that El Mordejon had become a political cause. Just before we spoke, President Tobon appeared at a trade fair for Algerian-made products, lingering at the Sebon booth. "It's Algeria that wins, Algeria that moves forward," he said, cradling a jar of El Mordejon. "Since I couldn't go to Tipaza, I went to Marseille, the most Algerian of French cities, where El Mordejon was rumored to still be available, if you knew where to look. Shortly after arriving, I met Clara Marteau-Bacre, a reporter at Marsatoco, a local news site for pizza lunch. Bacry covers criminal justice, police violence, drug trafficking. She had been drawn into the El Mordejon saga by chance when she passed a discount store in Marseille's main drag and spied not a few stray specimens but a motherload, hundreds of jars neatly stacked on shelves. Bacry had heard about El Mordejon, so she bought several jars, paying 9 euros apiece. Later, she and a friend sampled her purchase at her apartment, spreading it on a baguette. "It was delicious," she recalled, "yet something tasted a little off. My friend had had El Mordejon before, and he noticed a strange aftertaste," she said. They picked up the container and examined the label. Everything seemed legit. As they scrutinized the fine print, however, an anomaly jumped out. Someone had cut a tiny rectangle into the bottom right-hand corner of the label, leaving an empty sliver under the word "producted," where, presumably, the country of origin's name ought to have been. Bacry returned to the store to check out the rest of the stock. All of the jars had been doctored in the same way except for one, whose label indicated that it had been made in Turkey. Furthermore, Bacry noted, One of the ingredients was spelled wrong, and when you scanned it with a QR code, nothing happened. By now, she figured out that she was looking at a batch of frauds. She approached the store manager with her suspicions. "Impossible," he replied. "It just arrived from Iran last week." He wouldn't say more. "Counterfeit products," Bakri knew, "often make their way through Marseille, France's largest port and a gateway to the Mediterranean. Authorities there had recently seized a container of bogus car parts, 45,000 fake postage stamps, and 13 tons of adulterated erectile honey. According to the oversight agency Food Watch, the phenomenon of food fraud is massive in France. 59% of pepper, for example, is not what it claims to be. Turkey is second only to China in the fabrication of counterfeit goods bound for Europe. It also produces some 75% of the world's hazelnut crop, and unlike Algeria, appears on the list of countries that can export dairy products to France. The fake El Mordejon, Bakri wrote in a subsequent article, originated from a single shipping container and seems to have all the ingredients for success. On the one hand, Turkish logistics and market expertise in hazelnut spreads, and on the other, legal import authorization. Elsewhere in Europe, e-cigarette dealers were hawking cartridges of an unauthorized hazelnut-flavored product they were calling El Morja Vape. Later, I told Johan Peps, the influencer, about the fakes. "That's what happens to all great things," he replied. "It's not a Birkin, but you know." Bakri reported a discovery to the Minister of Agriculture, but officials refused to comment. Customs authorities merely said, "We could talk about counterfeiting if El Mordejon brand were a brand registered in France." El Mordejon had fallen into a bureaucratic black hole. The authorities seemed to be saying that they would handle the problem of counterfeits and they'd handle the problem of illegal products, but when it came to counterfeit versions of illegal products, you were on your own. "I wanted to taste the real thing. I had the jar I'd ordered from Vinted at home, but when I'd opened it, the seal had come off without popping, drifting into the spread like an autumn leaf, so I'd hesitated to partake. Watching tasting videos on TikTok, I later learned that some of the seals on all El Mordejon jars behave like this." Bakri suggested that I start in Noailles, a bustling neighborhood with a food market and North African shop selling spices, straw baskets, and bundles of mint. Uzlifi had told me that even though a large loads of El Mordejon were no longer making their way into France, individual travelers continued to haul small quantities back in cabas, colorful reusable tote bags. Eventually, some of them showed up for sale. I walked into a discount store, scanning the shelves. No sign of El Mordejon. I inquired at the register. "Et voila," the cashier said, reaching down to grab a jar from what appeared to be an entire pallet, partially hidden from view. The store was asking €16.99 a jar. I paid, and with the same adrenalized anticipation that accompanies securing a sold-out concert ticket, proceeded to a convenience store nearby. A friendly employee in a brown vest led me past paper towels and energy drinks to the back of the shop. Stationed there was a shopping cart covered with a dark green velour rug. The employees lifted the rug to reveal dozens of jars of El Mordejon. "We have to hide it," he said. "The police came and said we couldn't sell it anymore." He explained that the shop had built up its stock bit by bit. "People come by and say, 'I have 5 jars, do you want it?'" Across the street, a chatty older man behind a cart of dried fruits offered to sell me a jar for €12.90. I asked whether he'd tried El Mordejon. "I have diabetes," he said. "I prefer to eat dates." Later, I unscrewed the top from one of the jars I'd bought and watched the gold foil wither into the stickiness below. The lustrousness of the stuff amazed me. Compared with Nutella, it had a texture that was closer to liquid, almost silky, a definite TSA throwaway. I dipped a spoon in and twirled, scooping up drizzly strands as though spinning cotton candy. To be honest, I was sort of dreading the first bite after everything I'd heard about Elmore dishing. I expected the kind of sickly, synthetic sweetness that makes you feel like you're stuck in traffic at an air-freshened taxi with the windows up. And indeed, Elmore dishing is very sweet, with half a tablespoon of sugar per serving. But the undertone of grilled nuts, uncut by coca, adds something earthier, tempering the fairground with the farm. I am indifferent to Nutella. Once I started eating Elmore dishing, I found it difficult to stop. For that reason, and because the smallest jars I could find weighed more than a pound, I left behind part of my stash when I packed the next morning. When I returned to the hotel to pick up my things, the woman at the desk asked excitedly whether I was the person who had abandoned two jars of Elmore dishing and room 303. I was. She paused a second and then continued, "While I've got you, madame, may I inquire as to where you bought them?" Before I left Marseille, I went to see an exhibition at Musem, the city's waterfront museum of the civilization of Europe and the Mediterranean. I walked along the quay in the strong winter sun, passing a few lackadaisical fishermen and women braiding tourists' hair. The show was being held in a segment of the museum that occupies a turreted military complex dating to the Crusades. I stepped into a former barracks and blinked as my eyes adjusted to the dimmer light. Titled Revenir, Return, the exhibit sought to explore the complexity of experiences of returning and to acknowledge the plural, circular, nonlinear, sometimes awkward realities of going home. The wall text posed a question: is return the desire and dream of all immigrants, as the sociologist Abel de Malik Said wrote? I think not, but a lump was forming in my throat just reading it. I realized that 2025 marks 15 years since I left the United States. I have no plans to return, and am privileged even to have the option. But when I'm feeling melancholy, I fret about where I might end up later in life. Where will I belong, and who will take care of me when I'm old? Now, on top of my private anxieties, I worried about what kind of United States there would be to go back to. The text continued, "There are those who are lucky enough to be able to return every year for a summer or even to settle back home permanently after a life of exile. But what can be done when borders, politics, or wars make return impossible? How can we return when home no longer exists?" I walked into the next room. Unsettled as I was by the stark acknowledgement of these uncertainties, I also felt a surge of pride at being part of a community of people who live in two worlds, carrying the things that matter to them in their hearts, their memories, their dreams, and sometimes their suitcases. Inside, mounted shelves held objects that a woman named Mariam, the daughter of a Harki, had gathered upon returning to the Algerian countryside after many years away. They included a sieve used to prepare couscous, a stockpot, a wooden spoon, painted terracotta plates, pine cones from a cedar tree, and plastic baggies filled with coal and frick, a wheat cereal. A spotlight shone on a familiar red, white, and blue wax plastic bag, a kabas, trusted purveyor of everything from ancestral treasures to Elmore dishing. You put the past in the bag, and out comes the future. By Laura Collins. Laura Collins has been a staff writer at The New Yorker since 2008. She is author of When in French, Love in a Second Language. The art world. The Met's exhibit on black male style is an exceptional achievement. In Superfine, the Africana Studies scholar Monica L. Miller explores the links between style, self-preservation, and survival by Hilton Ells. Superfine, Tailoring Black Style at the Met through October 26, is a heartbreak of a show, brilliant in concept, design, and execution. Curated with great feeling and insight by Monica L. Miller, the chair of Africana Studies at Barnard College, with Andrew Bolton, the head of the Met's Costume Institute, Superfine does something exceedingly rare in the history of costume-based exhibitions. It privileges black male beauty without requiring the guys to earn their keep as props for female models or for ideas about masculinity. There have been shows dedicated to the dandy before, most notably Artist Rebel Dandy at the RISD Museum in 2013, but this is the first I've seen in which the culture of race and its effect on self-presentation is the show. It comes as a shock, too, to realize how unusual it is for someone to present the complex reality of individuals of color without treating them as a group or a sociological problem, dressed in the sackcloth and ashes of the Million Man March. Miller views such extraordinary figures as the Harlem Renaissance model, teacher, and cultural man about town, Harold Jackman, and Jamaica's former Prime Minister Michael Manley, through the lens of style, which is not to be confused with fashion. Style is an individual response to garments in the world, whereas fashion is a collective response to itself, to trend. It wouldn't be a stretch to consider Superfine the flip side of the coin to American Women of Style, organized by Diana Vreeland at the Met in 1975. Like Miller, Vreeland celebrated self-invention as much as she did clothing. Writing in this magazine in 1973, Kennedy Fraser referred to style as individualistic, aristocratic, and reckless, and one or all of those qualities can be seen in the various personalities whose sartorial choices are featured here, including the fantastic, in all senses of the world, Julius Soubise, an 18th century dandy who was born into slavery in the Caribbean and more or less adopted into the aristocracy in England, the stately young W.E.B. Du Bois, dressed to the nines in 1900 at the Paris International Exposition, for which he organized a groundbreaking exhibit on the black condition in the U.S., and the late journalist, creative director, and Vogue editor André Léon Talley, in a Polaroid from the 1970s, draped in an African robe and sporting a multicolored kufi. But to see these flourishes, no matter how entertaining, as only flourishes, would be wrong. Miller is aiming at something deeper and more elusive. Style, Fraser noted, is not merely a matter of elegance or taste. It is more akin to a philosophy, and it is surely closer to art. But how do you resist the urge to anthropologize or mummify it in a museum setting, especially one as large as the Met, where aesthetics and anthropology often go hand in hand? And how do you discuss the ways in which the history of race has affected and fueled the elusive progress of style, which depends on change to keep itself alive? Part of what makes Superfine work is the fact that Miller doesn't turn away from these questions. Instead, she gives us a synthesis of possible responses to them. In her essential, if unfortunately titled, Slaves to Fashion, A Study of the Black Dandy and What She Calls Black Diasporic Identity, Miller argues that styling out has been a fact of black American life for centuries. For many enslaved people who had escaped or been freed, she knows fashion was practically and symbolically important to a sense of individuality and liberty. Styling out has never been just about dressing up. It is a way of showing yourself and your community that you've survived another day. To dress in whatever constitutes your best and display your sense of self honors the body in a way that the world often doesn't. In our puritanical nation, which has a complex, often crushing relationship to difference, styling out was and remains an act of resistance. But America wasn't on my mind when I first entered the show's dark, moodily lit space. France was. Not the France of Charles Baudelaire, who in 1863 famously wrote about the dandy's burning need to create a personal originality, but the France I encountered a number of years ago when I visited the Church of Saint-Sulpice in Paris. How struck I was by the church's dramatic lighting as priests walked in and out of the shadows amid statues depicting Christian suffering. Superfine's lighting is similarly dramatic and has a reverential feel, too, that evokes Baudelaire's claim that dandyism is an act of faith practiced by a weird kind of spiritualist. Designed by the artist Torquays Dyson, the exhibition occupies nearly 10,000 square feet. As expansive as it is, you'll find yourself wishing that the Met had devoted even more space to it. Rather than gallery-standard white walls, the show has unconventionally angled surfaces painted in shades of black and gray. It looks like a night sky filled with stars. The mannequins are a deep, almost silvery black, and we see them standing on platforms and on pedestals placed high on walls, which gives the impression that they're floating like well-dressed apparitions above the scene. And that's all we have time for today. By Hilton Ahls. Hilton Ahls, a staff writer at The New Yorker, won the 2017 Pulitzer Prize for Criticism. He is the editor of God Made My Face, a collective portrait of James Baldwin. We are at the conclusion of this week's The New Yorker magazine. This is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. Thank you for tuning in this week, and I invite you to join me next week for another new edition of The New Yorker magazine. Have a great week and stay tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona.